This is Marcus Kauke, author of Making Channel Sales Work, 10 Tools to Create a World-Class Third-Party Selling Program, and you're listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas in order to succeed in the quickly changing field of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. Also, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Blinkist. Blinkist is an app that takes the key insights from the best nonfiction books and distills them into a format that you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes on your smartphone. Several of the books featured on the Marketing Book Podcast are on Blinkist. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Marketing Book Podcast listeners where you can sign up for free at Blinkist.com/Marketing Book Podcast. Blinkist is spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. And if you opt for the paid version, you'll get an additional 20% off, but only if you go to Blinkist.com/Marketing Book Podcast or just click on the link at MarketingBookPodcast.com. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome Marcus Kauke to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about the book he has co-authored with David Davies, Making Channel Sales Work, 10 Tools to Create a World-Class Third-Party Selling Program. Marcus Kauke is a Sandler trainer located in the southeast region of the United Kingdom. He speaks regularly on sales, sales management, company turnaround, and the successful recruitment of salespeople. And, interesting fact, his father was a colonel in the British Army and was awarded a Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, CBE. Marcus, congratulations on Making Channel Sales Work, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your co-author is David Davies, and I was excited because that's the same Dave Davies who was the lead guitarist for the British rock band The Kinks. So it is a different David Davies?
Thankfully, yes.
Okay. But you know, Dave's brother, Ray Davies, the lead singer, he was awarded CBE, just like your dad.
Excellent. Well, I'm not entirely sure my father was cut out to be a rock star, although he was wicked on the harmonica when he was drunk.
Oh, great, great. Well, you know, who knows? Maybe they were inducted at the same time. So I'm so glad to have you on after over 200 books. I haven't had one about channel sales, and I've had a number of listeners and people that I meet who say, you know, I really need to work on our channel. I've had one book about channel marketing, which is terrific, Marketing Multiplied, and now we've got this one. So I've got a great companion. I may put together a box set of your of your book and the other book for all these people that keep asking about, you know, how do I go about improving our channel sales? So what I did want to say, though, is for new listeners, you know, this is the Marketing Book Podcast. Why do I have a book about sales on it? And I like books about sales. And the most successful marketers have a deeper understanding of sales. And also sales and marketing, because of the changing way people are buying, they're having to work together more closely. But one other caveat for the listener. If you're thinking, oh, you know what, we don't sell through channels, this isn't relevant, I would just say, okay, you don't have to listen, but your next job might be at a company where you are selling through a sales channel, a partner's, and if you listen to this, you'll be glad you did, because in your job interview, you'll be that much better prepared. Now, Marcus, full disclosure, and for the benefit of the listener, you work for Sandler, and I'm a Sandler customer. For 15 years, I've been going to Sandler. I try to attend class every week. My trainer is Chad Stenzel, who you may know, and yep, he bought the business from Brad McDonald, and they can't get rid of me. But the foreword to the book is written by Dave Mattson, the CEO of Sandler, and I interviewed him because he's the co-author of Sandler Enterprise Selling, and that book is very nicely tied in with yours.
Absolutely. Before we go any further, can I just make a couple of points?
Yes, absolutely. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Sales is a subset of marketing, so they're intrinsically connected. And if they're not joined up, then no amount of great marketing is going to make the blindest bit of difference. And to your second point, which was whether or not you think you're involved in channels or not, 75% of all products sold globally today is sold through partners. And that's based on World Trade Organization statistics. So odds are, even if you don't think you're involved in the channel, you probably are.
Well, and that also might explain why I've had so many listeners ask me about this topic. So now I can point to this interview and to your book.
Great stuff. Well, encourage that a lot.
Okay. Well, so let's say you're at a cocktail party and you tell somebody you've written a book about channel sales. They're not, you know, they're not in this world that you and I and the listener are in. Explain what channel sales is.
Well, that's assuming A, I have a social life, and B, they don't fall asleep at the very thought. However, channel sales is anything, any form of sales and distribution that goes through a third party. It can be franchising, it can be multi-level marketing, it can be resellers, value-added resellers, managed service providers, it can be distribution. Anything like that is technically channel sales. So anything that involves partners or alliances.
And you say that selling through indirect sales channels has long been seen as the ugly sibling of direct sales. Why is that? Why do they not get the respect they should?
It's like new business versus account growth. New business carries the glamour. It's a bit like driving in golf. And account growth and account expansion is like putting. You make your money from growing accounts, but all the glamour is associated with the new business. In the sales environment, direct sales is seen as the sort of senior service. And channel is where not particularly effective salespeople who are good socially, you like having them around for the Christmas party, and you don't really want to fire them. So you say, you know, let's put Doug into the channel. What harm can he do? Mm-hmm. Historically, Tim Nice But Dim has ended up in the channel. Not everyone, but because the best channel managers are utterly, stupendously outstanding. But by and large, they're largely order takers who phone up their partners every month and say, what have you got for me? And they say, nothing. And the channel manager says, okay, I'll call you next month.
Yeah, right. And actually, at the end of the book, you have some very interesting math, and it has to do with hiring what a CEO needs to do to hire the right kind of channel person. And the upside and the downside of their success is almost exponential compared to the regular salespeople. Perhaps you should explain why channel sales management is, in fact, one of the toughest jobs in sales. I mean, I think even in the book, you talk about cat herding. But I had no idea cat herding was so difficult.
Absolutely. Well, I've spent quite a bit of time talking to Jay McBain, the principal analyst for global channels at Forrester. And he's identified at least 90 different functions. And we've identified another 20 or so that a channel manager could be responsible for in any given working day. And they fall into six buckets: strategy and design, finding and recruiting partners, enabling and developing them, managing their incentives and driving their behavior through motivation, co-selling and co-marketing, and managing and reporting. And there is no sales job on the planet that even comes close to that level of complexity.
Yeah, it seems like that's where you would want to have almost your most experienced people. But I got the impression sometimes they just taught, like you said, they toss the less experienced folks in there.
To take that point up, a channel manager is closer to a general manager profile than a sales manager. And a channel chief is closer to a chief executive type of role. When you break the competencies down into what actually is involved, you could easily be looking at their needing to have good business and financial acumen. They need to be good coaches, able to delegate, direct others, execute for results, solve problems, plan and manage activity and resources, be highly strategic. And in the next breath, they could be being really tactical, working with a partner, helping them to get a deal over the line, trying to manage. So in IT, for example, as buyer behavior is changing, you could easily be one of 12 partners operating on a particular opportunity with an end user customer, and they're maybe 7, 8, 9 layers deep in the stack. And if you aren't able to go from big picture to detail, engage with people with absolutely no power and only influence, you're pretty much dead in the water.
A feat to behold when it's done correctly. And I should say that in our small agency, we're a reseller. We've got, you know, software companies where we're the partner. So I was able to read the book and think, oh, I see how this company's done, you know, their partner program particularly well, and I see where others are lacking. But let's back up. Explain why companies should behave like partners are their best customers.
Well, a customer buys something from you. A partner takes you into multiple customers. That's the first thing. Also, what I see time and again, and I've been operating in and around channel sales for probably 30 years, when I was in recruitment, when I was selling software, and the last 15 years working with Sandler. And what I've tended to see is there seems to be a bit of a disconnect. The vendor tends to, if it's a large vendor, they'll tend to treat their partner as if they're a commodity. But what they forget is the partner sells for their reasons. They have their product, the vendor's products, in their range for their reasons. And unless you, as the manager of that relationship, understand their personal motivation, their drivers, their business strategy, what they're trying to achieve in their business, then chances are they're going to go silent on you. And you see this all the time. You go to exhibitions and shows, and the vendors are trying to sign anybody and everyone up. So long as they're still breathing and have a pulse, they'll sign them up as a partner. But what they end up doing is wasting a huge amount of effort and energy on non-producers. And so what they tend to do is they build a land army instead of a special forces unit. And our book is really focused on how do you get the best out of your channel? How do you deliver the most value to your channel partners so that they want to work with you? They're driven to push you forward over all of your competition.
Mm-hmm. You say that there are two questions channel sales managers should constantly ask themselves and address on a daily basis. And one is, what is in it for our partners? And two is, what are we doing to make sure they want to sell on our behalf? And yet, it seems like, based on my experience, there is a lot of self-centeredness on the part of vendors. Ugh. I'll give you an example. I have one client who's a distributor. And they went to a meeting of other distributors, and the manufacturer was there. And it brought to mind, and let me read an excerpt from your foreword. It says, leading your partners to success isn't about demanding, bullying, cajoling, or threatening. It's about earning respect and trust. It's about developing a following by serving them and their best interests, not lording it over them, crowing, and taking all the credit. And I swear, Marcus, I was at a presentation from the manufacturer, and that's exactly what this guy was doing. I should send him a copy of your book, but I don't think he would read it because he didn't get it. What is it about vendors that seems to make it look as if the empathy was surgically removed from their brains?
Well, can I ask the question slightly differently, which is, what are the qualities that make a good partner?
In life?
Well, I think to be a good partner from the vendor perspective, you actually have to care about your partner's success. You have to communicate with honesty, integrity. If you say you're going to do something, keep your word and do it. Try to understand them first, both internally and externally. Communicate to make sure that your side understand the importance of this relationship. You differentiate not in the features and benefits, because let's face it, a CRM system is a CRM system, an ERP system is an ERP system, and a thermostat is a thermostat. You differentiate in how you sell, not what you sell. You differentiate in the channel, in how you behave as a partner. And you need to teach them how to sell your stuff. You need to teach them as if they are your own. And you need to teach them to question for insight, not simply for understanding. You've got to help them to diagnose the problem so that they actually become valued by the end user instead of being treated like a commodity provider, which is just a race to the bottom on price. They need to understand that there has to be a win-win-win outcome. There has to be a win for the end user. There has to be a win for the partner, and there has to be a win for the vendor. And if any one of those isn't winning, it's the channel manager's responsibility to pull the plug. They need to protect their relationships. They need to treat their salespeople as if they were part of their own business. And before pointing the finger of blame at their partners for not producing, look in the mirror, because that's inevitably where the problems start. Now, they need to understand that failure is inevitable. It's a learning opportunity, and they shouldn't punish their partners for taking risks, because that will stop them from becoming creative and entrepreneurial. They need to prevent a culture of learned helplessness, which means that they can have tough, constructive, conflictive conversations, but they don't rescue, they don't interfere, they don't micromanage. They understand that together they can all get better. So they're the conduit to capture the lessons from the partnerships. And they need to understand that it takes time to build trust. It's a courtship. You know, you have to flirt. You have to fall in love, if you like, by understanding them, understanding the individuals who are going to be working with you, understanding the executive team and their vision. But the problem is that most vendors just turn up and say, well, sell my stuff.
Yeah, one of my favorite lines from the book is, you said, newsflash, your partners really don't care about what you want or what you are selling. Are there examples of companies maybe that had problems with channels where, what are some of the things they might have done so that they started to better understand and talk in terms that their partners understood better? For instance, instead of talking about, these are our features, advantages, and benefits, how are they able to come to a sense of reality and understand that that partner wants to grow their own business, and that the problems they're providing for their end customers aren't necessarily about just selling your product?
Fantastic question. The first thing is, be partner-centric. Instead of selling selfishly, be partner-centric. Focus on, it's like in every organization that really understands their customer, they understand that the customer experience is at the heart of everything that they do. With channel sales, you have to put the partner at the heart of everything that you do. And you need to understand who serves whom. You as the vendor serve your partners. They don't serve you. They're in business for their reasons. You understand what's in it for them, why they would want to sell on our behalf. And they understand that they have to get out of the way of their partner and their willingness to sell on your behalf, because they understand that service is not servitude. It's really about being able to help them get their needs met, and in turn, getting our own needs met. They need to understand that there is parity here. You know, even on your worst day, your partner is never more than or less than your equal. And in doing this, what we're finding is that our clients are, first of all, adopting that philosophy. Then what they're doing is they have a proper onboarding process, an onboarding process that takes 120 days, because in that first 4 months, the partner is deciding, have I really been sold a pup? Is this what I was sold in the first place? Or is this something quite different? Do I think that my account manager, my channel manager, is an oaf? Do they have my best interests at heart? And it's being able to help them understand what they need to know, by when they need to know it, and where they can find that information. So it's making sure, where possible, and it's not always possible, because I get it that some vendors can't yet afford maybe to build a partner portal, but making sure that the resources are available. And the collateral isn't just tedious data sheets that make them sound like a Me Too product. It's really useful stuff that helps them roll up their sleeves, go out, prospect, identify genuine opportunities, drive them through the identification process, qualify, co-develop solutions, propose and advance them, and then deliver the service at the same time as expanding those accounts, and then revisit their territory and account plans. And so providing them with tools that they use on a daily basis to help them sell, helping them to prioritize and get out early. One of the tools that we have in the book is called Pursuit Navigator. And Pursuit Navigator helps you to identify early whether you should get out of an opportunity or continue to pursue it, because you can and will win it, rather than you could but won't or shouldn't. Because when you look at the high cost of pursuit, the hidden cost of sale is astronomical. You know, in Sandler, we've identified the three highest hidden costs in any organization. Number one, wrong hires. Number two, the hidden cost of selling. And number three, the hidden cost of RFPs. Now, if you can eliminate those three, miraculously, your profitability goes up. You know, the cost of pursuit could easily be, in an enterprise sale, 30, 40 grand. And if you have to do 10 of those, that's 400,000 sunk just in pursuit. Why would you give away all that profit? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And as my former Sandler trainer, Brad McDonald, who now works for Sandler Corporate, one of his expressions I love is, no is my second favorite word. And that was where, if you can find out that your products or services or whatever are not a fit, the earlier you can find that out in the sales process, the better. But let me ask you about something else that I think is particularly relevant to a lot of the marketers listening. Now, you talked about just then a lot of the tools that a company can provide for its channel partners and then possibly even for their partners' customers. And there's an acronym in your book that I had not seen before, but I'd like to talk about it, and it's FUDWACA.
All right.
And that's FUDWACA. And this had so much relevance for marketing and creating content, as well as throughout the sales process. And FUDWACA, let me translate those, and I ask you to talk about some of these. It's frustration, uncertainty, doubt, worry, anger, concern, anxiety. When I saw that, I loved it, because the more that you're able to zero in on that, the primal brain gets engaged. Talk about that and power of that, and I guess why more companies don't do this.
More companies don't do it, I believe, because they've been conditioned. I have a poster on my wall from my third favorite website, a website called despair.com.
Oh, I love that. We'll include a link to that in the show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. It's great.
I use their cards for direct marketing because it's the antithesis to those ghastly posters of an eagle and it says dare to soar, or it's lonely on the last mile. I'm a big fan of the demotivational poster. And my favorite one at the moment is the tradition poster. It has a picture of the Pamplona bull run. And underneath, the headline is tradition. Just because you've always done it that way doesn't mean it's not incredibly stupid.
Right. And it's beautiful, high resolution photography. And if somebody walks by it in your office, they might think, oh, it's another one of those sort of office space motivational posters.
They used to have another fantastic one, which sadly they discontinued, but I've been begging them to bring it back. And it's a picture of a chain snapping. And it says, dysfunction. Have you ever considered that in all of your dissatisfying relationships, the one constant is you?
It's brutal. I'm sorry. I've gotten you off track. It's your third favorite website. Go ahead.
So remind me what we were talking about before we went off on a tangent.
Oh, FUDWACA. Oh, and why companies don't do that?
The reason why they don't is because they've been brought up in a tradition of feature and benefit selling. Mm-hmm. Features and benefits make you sound like everybody else. They extend the length of the sales cycle. They reduce the probability of closing. They raise cost in the mind of the prospect. Pain, on the other hand, does the opposite. Pain engages, instead of the intellectual brain, it engages the emotional brain. And 100% of buying decisions are 100% emotional 100% of the time. There are zero exceptions. I've taught people to sell military hardware. I've taught people to sell naked platters. I've taught people to sell legal services and software. And in every instance, whether it's a $3 billion sale or it's a 30-pound sale, it is emotion that drives the decision. When people are brain damaged and their emotional centers are damaged, they cannot make a decision. They cannot work out whether they want tea or coffee or what to wear. You can't override 300 million years of evolutionary hardwiring.
Very true. And you don't have to do it perfectly, as I like to say. You just have to do a little bit better than the next guy. And it really, your materials and your sales process, that'll really stand out. Let me talk about one aspect of sales that is extremely important, but feared and dreaded, and that's the topic of prospecting.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to explain this because the other day when I was at Sandler training, I actually had a copy of your book and Chad Stenzel was talking about this very topic. And I said, yeah, you know, just to underscore what Chad was saying, you said in your book, you prospect for choice. That's why you should prospect. Prospect for choice. Explain.
Well, if you have a full pipeline and you have 300 to 500% more at the qualified moving to closable stage than you need in order to hit your quota, you can sell freely. You can pick and choose who you work with. You can walk away from bad business. If someone's trying to penny pinch and lowball you, you can say, you know, Doug, it sounds like we're not a fit.
You can say, it sounds like lowest price is most important to you. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I get the sense you're buying on price and you're going to go for the low bid. Look, we don't get involved in bids and tenders. Look, if that's going to be a deal breaker, just tell me no and I'll leave. And being able to sell with that level of confidence is critical. Now, I want to bring something back. You mentioned Fuddwacker as a platform in order to start developing your messaging and identify prospects. Another tool that we've got in the book is called CARE, K-A-R-E. I like to call it SCARE, although I'll probably get in trouble for putting that in.
Yeah, don't let Dave Mattson hear you say that.
S stands for SAC. There are customers you should get rid of. In fact, you should encourage them to go to your closest competition so they can waste their time, tie up their customer service, drive down their price, and cost them money. Now, K stands for keep. These are maintenance accounts. They're babysitting accounts. And this is a segmentation activity, very much in the marketing space. Which are the accounts that, as long as you don't drop the ball, will continue to come back and spend money with you year on year on year? A stands for attain. This is new business, new business wins. These are the ones that traditionally you're picking up the phone, dialing for dollars, trying to go out and win new logos. And then you have R, recapture. Maybe you blew it. You were outsold. New management came in and they decided they were going to bring their favorites in and you lost that business. Whatever the reason, you already have a good insight into their workings. You understand their philosophy. You understand their people, their structure. Why not sell back to those people? But the sexiest part is E, expand. Expand accounts. And I'll give you a classic example of this. I have a client at the moment who they were sweating blood. I mean, literally sweating blood because their target had been increased by 20%. One session enabled me to find 200% growth for every one of the 10 people that I was training. Now, even if they only get 1/10 of that, they still hit their target. But chances are every one of them is going to come in 300 to 400% of the stretch target that the management was putting in, because the management actually only really needed them to do 12%, but they gave them 20. And they were crying in their soup over this because they had no idea how they were going to do it. And simple tools that enable marketing to work with sales and then the channel managers to work with the partners in order to be able to identify where they should invest their time, their money, their resource for the best bang for their buck, that is marketing through and through. And channel management requires you to be expert at helping your partners to segment their customer base. And that tool alone is worth the price of admission.
And I would submit that whoever that partner is, none of their vendors will have come to them and said, let's talk through this as it relates to your customers. But I'll go even further, Marcus. There are so many people in the business world who don't really understand what, you know, how marketing can better align with sales, and they may not even understand what the marketing people do. If anyone listening who's a marketer were to sit down with their salespeople or their management, because one thing I hear from a lot of marketers is we don't have any goals. They won't tell us what's going on. Go into that room and say, do the care. Say, who do we want to keep? You know, who do we want to acquire? That always seems to blow their minds. They say, oh, you mean like go after, we're waiting for them to come to us. I think that would make marketers be perceived in a very different, in a different manner.
I absolutely agree. Now, there's another tool, two other tools that we built into the book. We baked a lot of these tools into the book straight out of the enterprise selling platform, but we've tailored them specifically for the channel. Mm-hmm. One is called the client-centric satisfaction tool. Yeah. And it needs to be designed from three perspectives. One is, how is the partner going to assess the vendor's contribution? And how is the vendor going to assess the partner's contribution? And then how is the end user customer going to assess and measure the partnership's contribution to their business? And in doing this, how many times have you been to a hotel and you got that terrible customer survey that was all about getting information the hotel wanted you to talk about? So, for example, the speed of check-in, the speed of check-out, the quality of the food, the quality of the shower cap.
Yeah.
When actually what you really wanted to do was talk about the soundproofing, because your room was next to the elevator, right next to the ice machine, overlooking the pool, and there was a stag party and you couldn't get a wink of sleep.
And you weren't invited to the party.
And you weren't invited to the party. And so the client-centric satisfaction tool, or the, as we've termed it, the partner-centric satisfaction tool, is really about making sure that each party, each stakeholder, is measuring the stuff that matters most to them. And in doing that, we have baked in quarterly reviews, and it's a quarterly value review, not the traditional quarterly business review, which is every quarter I try and drag in your senior executive so I can peddle more stuff to. It's working.
That's not what you're supposed to do, folks.
Absolutely. What instead we're doing is we're baking into that, what is it that they need from us in order to feel that we're bringing real value to the party? How are they going to measure it? What's the benefit that they're looking to derive out of it? And too often, we see vendors avoiding that level of scrutiny because they don't want to hear bad news. One of the things I teach my clients is seek out bad news, seek out criticism, because it's the only way you're going to improve. And digging your head into the sand, pretending it's not going to happen, is just waiting to be fired. Now, I've done a lot of work in the media space. And media organizations, I've heard them say, a proverb in media is, you're never more than 3 years from being fired. How stupid is that? It costs you a fortune to acquire them. You're probably only going to make a profit at the tail end of the first year because you can't sell for toffee. By the time you've got this account, you really want to keep it. Why not keep it for 10, 15, 20 years and grow it 30% a year or 100% a year? That, to me, strikes me as being far savvier business practice than simply going after new business, which costs you 6 to 9 times more than expanding your existing accounts. So once you've done that segmentation using the CARE model, then work out how you're going to pursue it. Work out, we have another tool in there called Growth Account Booster, which is where sales, marketing, and operations work together with the partner to identify how we're going to grow this account. What's the 2-year footprint that we can develop? Where have we come from? Where are we now? Where are we headed? What are the opportunities? What's the probability of us closing? Where do we need to invest resources? Do we need to recruit ahead of time? Because it looks like we're going to be winning this business. We've got a close enough relationship with the senior executive team and the end user because we've earned that right. And this comes back to another crucial point that we tried to make within the book, which is it any wonder that partners don't let vendor channel managers anywhere near the end customer in so many cases? Right. They don't deserve it. I mean, if you look at the turnover, I talk about this thing called vendor fatigue. You might have 10 different partners. On average, they will spend 2.1 years in the job. The first 6 months is trying to find the restroom. The next 6 months is throwing their hands in the air and saying, woe is me, everything that came before me is rubbish. Then the next 6 months, implementing change after change, reporting, messing with the portal, messing with registration, messing with marketing, collateral, and all of that stuff. And then the next 6 to 7 months, getting their CV out in the market so that they can get their next job. They haven't earned the trust. And channel management is all about learning to influence and to manage without power. You have to do it only through influence, and you have to earn that trust. You have to earn that influence. And it's by starting out with a partner-centric perspective.
Absolutely. Marcus, one other thing I want to ask about the book that I think is really important, and it's based on One of the challenges I hear from a lot of vendors and manufacturers is that they want more partners. They're trying to find more partners. And earlier in our talk, you talked about how they'll sign up anyone who can fog a mirror.
Yeah.
And just so everybody knows, that's not a good idea.
Yeah. Bad, bad, bad idea.
Yeah. What are some of the questions that a vendor should be asking before they sign everybody up or in order to find good partners?
Well, there are a number of questions. The first thing is, can you pin your logo to their office door? You know, are they big enough to be able to bring you a stream of business? I'm not saying picking up the odd partner who will just bring you one deal a year is a terrible thing, but they're not going to make you wealthy. They're not going to help you expand. Is someone besides their chief executive, their top salesperson? Because if they're dependent on somebody who could just as easily be clipped by a bus, and then they're not a partner anymore, that's a problem. How do they get new business? Do they tell you, oh, well, you know, we get all of our business by referral? Well, that's fine and dandy, but unless they're systematic about it, and I can promise you now, almost none of them are systematic. What they do is they get referrals as a nice surprise out of left field, okay?
It's hard to plan for that.
Well, it's impossible to plan for that. But the reality is you can be systematic. I build my business largely by referral. And the majority of this is planned. I work with referral partners. And that's exactly what your channel partners are. Then you also think about, well, is their culture more technical than sales? Because if they're just a technical partner, they're not going to be bringing you deal flow. What they want to do is implement, because that's how their business is set up. So, you know, are your business cultures compatible and complementary? What kind of reputation do they have? How easy are they to deal with from the start? How do they feel about you talking to their customers? Are their salespeople asking you good questions? This is something that fascinates me. I remember sitting through what was an excruciating 90 minutes of my life, which I'm never going to get back, sadly. And it was this lovely guy called Tom from Texas. And he spent 90 minutes throwing up PowerPoint slides about flow meters. And it was literally looking at the rates of flow. It was just a feature and benefit. Well, it was a feature presentation. That wasn't helping them to sell. And not one of the salespeople in this engineering company ever asked, well, Tom, that's fine and dandy, but why would anyone give a damn? Why would they care? How do I use that to sell it? What are the kind of questions I need to be asking? So they ask me for that stuff. Another really important question is, do they welcome your onboarding process or do they see it as an imposition? Because if they do, this isn't going to work. Will they let you train their salespeople as if they're your own? Will they do regular pipeline reviews meetings with you where you constructively challenge one another about the pipeline to make sure it's real? I have a bunch of questions that I give to my clients on a pipeline review. And it's so important that people really understand the critical nature of the pipeline to see what's real and what's not. You know, what's new in the pipeline? What's advanced in the pipeline? Why? What hasn't? Why hasn't it? What are you going to do to disqualify it or advance it in the next 7 days? What wins have you had? Why did you win? What losses have you had? Why did you lose? Was it about money? Could you have found out that money was going to be the deciding factor any sooner? What lessons did you learn? Things like that. Do you both agree what good looks like? And have you identified what a win-win-win outcome looks like? Because if you haven't done any of that stuff, I promise you, you're going to be wasting a huge, an obscene amount of time.
And I would think that if a vendor does that for a partner and asks those kinds of questions, they would become differentiated immediately. Just like you said, you differentiate by the way you sell. If a partner were to get that sort of those sort of questions, they would think, no, these guys are a hassle. Okay, that's a good red flag. That means, you know, no is my second favorite word. This isn't going to work out. I want to know that early. But if some partner were to say, these are great questions, that for me would be a good sign. Like, oh, well, maybe they want to work with us. Maybe we can help them, even though they might not have all the right answers for us at this point.
We're launching the Making Channel Sales Work training program early next year as a formalized program to take people from never having worked in the channel before to becoming great channel managers and then to become channel chiefs. And I believe firmly that it's going to be the new route to chief executive. I think that the traditional route of CFO and VP of sales, which is where the majority of CEOs have come from, is going to go by the wayside. And the two new routes will be the channel chief and the head of data analytics, because these are people who really understand what's going on. And they need to be able to understand the competitive landscape. They need to understand what's going on. They need to understand trends in the market. They need to understand what resources are available. And those two are going to be the ones who are going to be determining the future of the business, not the sales director and not the CFO.
That's very interesting to hear that the people who are in channel sales are migrating into the CEO's office. And it goes back to the beginning of this conversation about how much they have to know and how complex the task is.
Can I take your point about asking fantastic questions just a step further?
Oh, please.
One of the tools that we've developed is this competitor impact tool, and we've adapted it specifically for the recruitment process in recruiting partners. So looking at, for example, the markets in which a prospective partner is strong or weak, how's that going to affect our decision to proceed? Do they cover markets which we want to access? Do we offer them potential to access markets that they want to exploit but can't because of their current portfolio? Are they positioned primarily as technical or sales? What's their market focus? Is it enterprise, mid-market, SME? How does the market perceive them? How do their customers perceive them? With whom do they regularly compete? How are they positioned in comparison with their top 20% of competitors? What do we know about their management, their sales, their account managers, their operations, marketing, finance, customer service? What gaps exist in our understanding of their people? If you, as the channel manager, ask these kind of questions of yourself, then you can save yourself a vast amount of time. I always teach my clients, you are dead forever. And wasting a moment, one single moment, on a non-opportunity strikes me as madness. You say that no is your second favorite word. For me, I think it's my favorite, because it's like saving a goal in soccer. If you can save a goal, you win on goal difference. And it's important to keep the ball out of your net. If you happen to score along the way, that's a plus. But the problem is that so often people are so focused on the wrong end of the problem. They're focused on trying to get people on board rather than disqualify out. I do a calculation with direct salespeople. In an enterprise environment, the traditional belief is it'll cost something like 5 to 6 times salary to make a wrong hire. But when you actually extrapolate out based on the lifetime value of the customers that they're going to lose or allow the competition to win, the repeat business, the referral business, it can easily be 30 to 125 times the salary. And that's with a direct salesperson who is basically carrying a tenth of the target that a channel manager will carry. Now, when you start talking about those numbers, recruitment becomes utterly critical. And that's why we've put an entire chapter in the book on how to recruit a fantastic channel manager. But again, most people, like I said earlier, they're going to go for Tim Nice but Dim.
Tim Nice but Dim. But you know, that comes back to the comment I made earlier about all the math. So in other words, it's one thing to say hiring is important. Yeah, that's great, Marcus. But when you put all the math in there, I think it really made even me pay attention as to why it's so important and why screening of these folks is so vital.
Being able to do pain by numbers does is it turns your tactical conversation into a strategic one that the C-suite need to be involved in. Because if you know how to do that, you can take your partners and elevate them and take them to a much higher level within their end user account. Now, that is valuable to the partner. That is being partner-centric. And that's why they'll be loyal and they will take only you in.
If readers took only one thing from your book, what would you hope it would be?
I'm torn. The obvious one, which I've already mentioned, is be partner-centric. But the other one is that you have rights as a channel manager. I think I'll go with that one.
There's a whole chapter on that that we didn't talk about.
In fact, if anyone wants a free chapter, I'm happy to give them the channel manager's right one.
Talk about the channel manager's rights. What do you mean by that?
The channel manager has rights to be treated with respect. They have the right to be treated as an equal. They have the right to get to the truth. They have the right to prospect and fill the pipeline. They have the right to challenge. They have the right to get answers to the questions that they asked. It has to work for both sides. They have the right to upfront contract, which is a technical term that we use in Sandler, which is you agree at the beginning what you want to have happen at the end. And then you hold one another accountable for committing and seeing it through. You have the right to engage the end user. You have the right to honor agreements. And the problem is that channel managers abdicate their rights because they don't think they have any. I went up for an award recently, and I had a row with one of the judges. I'm sure I didn't win for other reasons, but I had a row with one of the judges because I said, yeah, salespeople have rights. And, no, they don't. I said, of course they do. If you give away your power by putting your prospect on a pedestal, then you've already abdicated control. You need to have parity, equal business stature. And there are many of these that we've listed in the book. I'm just conscious I don't want to overstay my welcome. But if you don't understand that you have rights as a channel manager to ask tough, gnarly, difficult, insightful questions and get the answers to the questions that you asked, not the one that they want to answer, because that's often the case as well, you have the right to be strategic. You're not just shifting product. If all you are is a box shifter, you deserve to be at the bottom of the pile. And based on the evidence that's coming out now, Coca-Cola, I believe, laid off 21,000 salespeople this year, and they outsource sales to their bottling partners. I believe that's the trend that is going to happen. And more people are going to be either going into partners to be the direct salesperson, or the cream are going to rise to the top, and those are the ones that are going to become the channel managers, the leaders of the future.
Interesting. Well, Marcus, let's move on. What books have inspired your working career?
So many. I've listened to about 700 in the last 4 years because my eyesight went and I discovered Audible. I think Just Listen by Mark Gulston is a must read, and his other book, Talking to Crazy, is fantastic. I think that Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday is a spectacularly good book. Clarity by Jamie Smart. Asking Questions the Sandler Way by Antonio Garrido is a fabulous book. The Contrarian Salesman by Jody Williamson is excellent. The You Can't Teach a Kid to Ride a Bike, that's what got me into Sandler in the first place. I think Essentialism by Greg McKeown is fantastic. And Randy Patterson's book, How to Be Miserable, is a fantastic book as well. So those are ones, and those are just the ones off the top of my head. Oh yeah, and Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Yes. Well, we will make sure to include links to every one of those in your episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. Are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or have heard of that you looking forward to reading or listening to?
I'm enjoying Traction by Gino Wickman.
Oh yes, yes. I've read that one twice. That's great. We're implementing it too.
Well, very good. The Organizational Excellence by Dave Mattson is fantastic. Accountability by Hamish Knox is really good. I think also Profit First. Profit First is a fantastic concept. The first thing you do, every $100 that comes in, you take your profit out first, and then everything else gets paid out the rest. And it's a fantastic way of running a business.
Well, Marcus, how best can listeners learn more about you and the book?
Go to my LinkedIn profile. Just look me up, Marcus Cauchi, Cauchi. Connect with me. Follow me. I have a YouTube channel. I'm the_inquisitor on Twitter. And if you're in the southeast of England and you fancy crashing a class, just drop me a line. You'll be very welcome. No charge. Just be lovely to see you.
Well, and you know, it's not just in the southeast of the UK. At the end of the book, it reminds people that they can go to Sandler.com and click on the button to find a training location, select your location, and find one in your area, and then call them and mention this book, and they'll reserve your place at the next workshop. So, well, we're going to have a lot of links in your episode show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And for the listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your podcast player of choice, like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode on your podcast player and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is Making Channel Sales Work, 10 Tools to Create a World-Class Third-Party Selling Program. The authors are Marcus Kauke and David Davies. Marcus, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Doug.
And that closes the book on episode 209 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Special thanks to our sponsor, Blinkist. To support the Marketing Book Podcast and start your free Blinkist trial or get 20% off your yearly plan, visit Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast or just click on the link at marketingbookpodcast.com. And please join us next time as we welcome Professor Malcolm McDonald back to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about the new book he has co-authored with Grant Oliver, Malcolm McDonald on Value Propositions, How to Develop Them, How to Quantify Them. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by Sean Armstrong.